to translate novels as a literary translator. But this war, or this catastrophe, let me say, I don't prefer to use the word war, because what we are witnessing is a catastrophe cannot be described. Anyway, yeah, I used to translate literature, which means that I'm a sensitive person with many emotions, so you need that in order to translate poetry or translate novels or something like that. So as a this catastrophe changed us forever, all of us, even our jobs. So yeah, I moved to be a medical translator and medical interpreter at a field hospital here near between Rafah City and Khan Yunis City in the south of Gaza Strip. Actually, my work as a medical translator, it was the first time to be in the field, actually, in such situations. And I can say that I'm witnessing a very horrible situation, very, very, very horrible situations. I'm witnessing daily many casualties that are arriving to the field hospital because we don't have any. We lost every governmental medical services because of the destruction of many, many hospitals. Even the only hospital here in Rafah, which is Al-Najjar Hospital, it cannot provide the necessary medical health services. So in the field hospital, which established by the IMC and the International Medical Corps, they are actually in only 2 months, they performed about 1,000 major surgeries, which is really, really a great thing to have. And even related to the out department, to the outpatient departments, we are talking about consultations of maybe 30,000. So yeah, we are trying hard to provide our people with the necessary medical services, as well as the mental health and the CP, which is the child protection. We are doing our ultimate efforts in order to try hard to provide the people, or the civilians and the innocent people here, to provide them with the medical services and other services. And let me use what Michel Foucault once said, because we are no prophets. Our job is to make windows where we're once walls. So we are trying hard is to create windows on the walls that this catastrophe is trying to build.
Finally, Mohammed Abu Lebda, we're going to be joined by Rachel Corrie's parents and the activist who held her hand as she lay dying. This is 21 years ago in Rafah. She was crushed to death by an Israeli military bulldozer as she tried to prevent the demolition of a Palestinian home. You shared with us a picture from Rafah in 2003. You were a little boy at the time, with the caption, "My grandmother with her neighbor and my sister Ozan after their home was destroyed by an Israeli bulldozer." Right around the time Rachel was trying to protect homes as a U.S. activist. Your thoughts on her significance, and how is she remembered in Rafah?
Okay, let me say that Rachel Corrie is being remembered. Every single person here in Rafah, in Gaza in general, in Gaza Strip in general, and especially in Rafah, every single person knows Rachel Corrie. Even the late generations, all of them, allow me to tell you the main reason. Actually, Rachel Corrie became an icon, not only here in Gaza Strip, not only for the Palestinians, the Palestinian people, but for the rest of the world, because she passed away, or she was killed because of her because she was trying to deliver a very important message. It's the most important message in the world, which is peace. And actually, for me, this is the main thing that we need to focus on in order to achieve what Rachel Corrie was dreaming to achieve, which is a peace for the Palestinians. So what matters of what matters for me in Rachel Corey a story is that she left her home, she left her parents and her family, and she came to a country that she never visited before, and she came into to a conflict zone, which is considered as a dangerous zone. So her ideas to come to here, actually it's a privilege. It's a she's really I want to say that she's being remembered here because of the story and the message she tried to deliver, and this this and Rachel Corey's story should strengthen us here while we are living these horrible situations. We need to remember Rachel Corey and her courage to come to a dangerous area. Not only that, trying to defend the people, the voiceless people, to be the voice of the voiceless people here, and to stand in front the ultimate power. She stand in front of tanks and bulldozers, trying to defend the people here in Gaza Strip, which I don't know what is a great what act will be greater than Rachel Corey dead. So I'm really grateful for Rachel Corey, and I want to say that people like Rachel Corey will never die, ever.
Well, Mohamed Abu Lebda, poet and translator from Rafah, thank you so much. Your words are being heard around the world and by her parents, who are going to be joining us next. I'm looking at your GoFundMe page, Mohamed, which quotes another poet. You say, "All what we seek for is to live like any human being in this earth. Helping us means you are taking action, supporting humanity." Because the famous poet Dante said, "The hottest places in hell are reserved for those who in times of great moral crisis maintain their neutrality." Thank you for talking to us today on Democracy Now!, Mohamed Abu Lebda. Next up, we continue to remember the U.S. peace activist Rachel Corey, killed 21 years ago, March 16, 2003, when she was crushed to death by an Israeli military bulldozer as she tried to prevent the demolition of the home of a Palestinian pharmacist. It was 3 days before the U.S. invaded Iraq. Back in 20 seconds.
يطلعنا بطيارات ونزلنا بوابير يا قلبي مثل دخان البوابير هو يلعن أبو الغربية يما وبلاد البرازيل ولا سعى فارق هالحباية
Flood of Tears by Palestinian singer Jawahir Shofani. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Saturday marked the 21st anniversary of the death of U.S. peace activist Rachel Corey. She was crushed to death by an Israeli military bulldozer in Rafah on March 16, 2003, 3 days before the U.S. attacked Iraq. Rachel was 23 years old. She was an Evergreen College student from Olympia, Washington. She went to Gaza with the International Solidarity Movement, which formed after Israel and the United States rejected a proposal by then UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Mary Robinson to place international human rights monitors in the occupied Palestinian territories. Rachel Corey was crushed to death by a U.S. Caterpillar bulldozer that was run by the Israeli military. She'd been trying to prevent the demolition of the home of a Palestinian pharmacist in Rafah, near the border with Egypt. Eyewitnesses say she was wearing a fluorescent orange vest. She was in full view of the bulldozer's driver, as photographs show.
In June 2003, the Israeli military concluded her death was, quote, an accident. Human rights groups condemned the Israeli army's investigation as a sham. A year later, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former Secretary of State Colin Powell's chief of staff, told Rachel's parents he did not consider the Israeli investigation credible, thorough, or transparent. Rachel's parents initiated lawsuits against Israel, the Israeli military, and the Caterpillar Corporation. But a U.S. federal appeals court ruled they could not sue the company because that would force the judiciary to rule on a foreign policy issue decided by the White House. In its ruling, the three-judge panel said the case could not go to court without implicitly questioning and even condemning U.S. foreign policy towards Israel. In 2015, the Israeli Supreme Court rejected an appeal from Rachel Corrie's parents after they'd sued the Israeli military Ministry of Defense for a symbolic $1 in damages and upheld a lower court's ruling that cleared the military of responsibility, saying Rachel's death had taken place in a, quote, war zone. In a minute, we'll be joined by Rachel's parents and one of her colleagues with the International Solidarity Movement. But first, this is Rachel Corrie in her own words from a documentary about her by Concord Media called Death of an Idealist.
I've been here for about a month and a half now. And this is definitely the most difficult situation that I've ever seen. In the time that I've been here, children have been shot and killed. On the 30th of January, the Israeli military bulldozed the two largest water wells, destroying over half of Rafah's water supply. Every few days, if not every day, houses are demolished here.
More, we're joined in Olympia, Washington, by Rachel's parents, Cindy and Craig Corrie. After she was killed, they devoted their lives to what Rachel Corrie lived and died for and founded the nonprofit Rachel Corrie Foundation for Peace and Justice. Cindy's the foundation's president, Craig the treasurer. They've also gone on interfaith peace missions to Israel, Gaza, the West Bank. Also with us in London is Tom Dale, a writer who's worked in civilian protection, conflict analysis, and journalism in the Middle East. His new piece for Jacobin is headlined, Rachel Corrie Gave Her Life for Palestine. In 2002 and 3, he too volunteered in Rafah with the International Solidarity Movement alongside Rachel. On March 16, 2003, a little after 5 p.m. in Rafah, he witnessed this U.S.-made bulldozer run over Rachel. He held her hand as she lay dying on a gurney in the ambulance taking her to the hospital. Welcome to all of you. I want to begin with Tom. Describe that day. What motivated you both, and what motivated Rachel to stand there in front of this bulldozer with that fluorescent vest on as it came forward and crushed her?
So to give some context and background, the International Solidarity Movement group in Rafah at that time were mostly concerned to protest against and oppose the demolition of homes that were being carried out on the border with Rafah and Egypt. And there was no allegation in the overwhelming majority of cases that these homes were being demolished due to anything that the people who lived in them had done. They were being demolished simply because Israel had decided that its soldiers based along that border strip wanted a tactical advantage, and that involved clearing a 300-metre strip full of family homes, the overwhelming majority of which were refugees. And now, at the particular time Rachel was killed, a bulldozer turned toward one of those homes, the home of Dr. Samir Nasrallah. Dr. Samir and his young family were friends of Rachel. She'd stayed with them. She'd lived with them. She knew them intimately. And she placed herself in between the bulldozer and the home, as we had done so many times before, and as we had done earlier in that day. And what we had learned over the course of several months is that the bulldozer drivers were able to see us, were able to recognise what would be too far, and they were able to stop or withdraw at an appropriate moment. But on this case, the bulldozer driver just kept on going. Rachel was sort of forced to climb up a kind of roiling mound of earth in front of the bulldozer. I think you heard earlier Cindy quoted saying that her head was above the top of the bulldozer blade. That's absolutely accurate. It's almost as if the driver would have been able to look her in the eye. But as he kept going, ultimately she lost her footing and she was sucked down into the earth and terribly, horrifically died. At that point, I ran to call for an ambulance. I learned then that Dr. Smear himself had seen the incident too and had called the ambulance. And we had been living with these families, as I say. Rachel had been living with the Nasrallahs. I'd been living with other families along the border. And that was an expression of a really deep commitment to the principle of shared humanity. Rachel took on the cause of those families as if that cause was her own. And she made that cause her own. And that's what motivated us to take that stand.
You quote Rachel's diary. It's absolutely amazing. She wrote this, of course, before her death, and she said she had a dream. Do you have it in front of you, or I'll read it?
Please do read it. Thank you.
Rachel wrote, she dreamed that she was falling, quote, falling to my death off of something dusty and smooth and crumbling like the cliffs in Utah. But I kept holding on, and when each new foothold or handle of rock broke, I reached out as I fell and grabbed a new one. I didn't have time to think about anything, just react. And I heard, I can't die. I can't die, again and again in my head. If you can talk about what it means to hear Muhammad right now, talking about how Rachel is remembered, Tom, and what happened to you as you went in the ambulance with her to the hospital?
Yeah, that's correct. So, I mean, regrettably, by the time we got to the hospital, Rachel was dead. As I say, like on the way, I'd been sort of hot, just steadying her hands on her abdomen. You know, of course, it was like a terrible moment. We were all distraught. We knew Rachel. We cared for her greatly. She was one of us. Then immediately, of course, we were pushed into the cycle of responding to the series of bizarre lies that were being told by the Israeli Defense Forces. And in terms of what it means to hear, Mohammed say that right now, well, of course, I'm very grateful. It means a lot, given that, of course, the situation that Mohammed and his family and all of Rafarin is now is so terrible that he even has a thought for someone who was standing there 20 years ago is really remarkable and speaks to sort of the power of Rachel's message. And I really hope we can sort of repay that in the international community and use this just as an opportunity, as another spur to direct attention back to Rafah, direct our energies back toward putting the pressure on politically to protect Rafah from and Gaza in general from a future onslaught.
Tom, I want to bring in Rachel's parents, Cindy and Craig Corey, speaking from Olympia, Washington. That's where Rachel went to college. In fact, I think I met both of you for the first time back in 2003. I just happened to be giving the graduation address at Evergreen College that year. It was the largest graduation class ever, but it was missing one student who was supposed to be graduating, and it was your daughter, Rachel. And so, Cindy, you gave an address to the graduating class as well. 21 years later, I offer my condolences again to you. And I'm wondering your thoughts as you listen to Mohammed on the ground in Rafah, talking about your daughter and what she has meant for the people of Rafah, Gaza, and beyond.
Thank you, Amy. I had a bit of difficulty hearing Mohammed, but what I know from our experience this past 21 years is that for Palestinians everywhere, Rachel's story has been very important. They tell us over and over again how much it meant that someone from Olympia, Washington, that had no reason to be in Gaza, except that she had learned about the situation and knew that they were greatly in need, that she came to them and that she stood to try to prevent the demolition of the many demolitions of Palestinian homes that were happening at the time. And Rachel connected with the community. That was important to her. She worked with women's groups, with children's groups. Not only were homes threatened, but wells were threatened. She slept at the wells with other activists. Rachel was there with Tom and with others from the UK, from the US, and people from other countries during the early time that she spent in Gaza. We're also often approached by younger people who have heard the story, some when they were children that remember it, and tell us that it changed their lives, changed the course of the direction of their lives, that they then felt that there were meaningful things that they needed to look for, meaningful ways to contribute in this world.
And Craig, your thoughts as well. 21 years later, with Rafah once again in the news, with President Biden saying that an Israeli invasion of Rafah is a red line, but not saying there would be consequences if the Israeli military went over that line.
Yes, yeah, so I was listening today. I was thinking that for me, and it's different for other members of the family, but we were using Rachel's memory and what she was doing to as a portal for people to understand from the United States, to understand what was going on in Gaza, what was happening to her friends, and partially the horror that's going on now. And I think at this point, we have to be looking directly at the Palestinians and hearing their voices, as you allowed today. There's never been a red line that any American president has, well, that's not quite true, but recently enforced against Israel. And to me, as long as Israel is coveting the lands and the homes of Palestinian people, there will not be peace in Israel and Palestine, and neither the Israeli people nor the Palestinian people will be safe. So I think really the difference between Rachel, Tom, the rest of the ISM, the difference between them and the rest of us is that they refused to look away when all this was going on. And the rest of the world did look away.
You know, one of the ways Rachel's words have been preserved was because of Alan Rickman. And Craig, I just read a piece you wrote after the actor and director Alan Rickman died. You wrote it in The Guardian. And you talked about what a difference he made in making those words into that play, My Name is Rachel Corey, based on her diaries and her emails. And I'm looking at a piece. 6 weeks before opening night, the theater announced it was indefinitely postponing the production. The move that was widely criticized as an act of censorship finally opened in October 2006. And if either of you could comment on the canceling of people in this country and around the world now who express concern about what's happening in Gaza, and also talk about your trip to meet with the Nasrallahs, the Palestinian pharmacist family whose home Rachel was protecting.
That's a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
I'll start with Alan. And the play. And I guess in that article, what I thought of is that play, what people won't understand about it is that it's actually funny. He managed to get Rachel's sense of humor. And he edited those words along with Catherine Viner, and we're grateful to both of them. But he managed to get Rachel's humor into the play. And I think that brought her personality. It made her human. And I'm grateful forever for that. The play has been seen on every continent in the United States, in the world, and except Antarctica. And with Cindy and I have seen that, I think, in maybe 6 countries and 7 different languages. So it was delayed in opening in the United States, but it had 2 runs in Great Britain, in London, before that. And it did eventually open in New York City. And since then, it's been also all over the United States. And it's actually, there's going to be a reading in a few days in Seattle again. So I'll let Cindy talk, I think, more about the other.
We visited the Nasrallah family in September of 2003. It was our first trip to the region. It was very important for Craig and me to see the place where Rachel had stayed and where her life ended. We traveled to Rafah with the help of our Palestinian friends who met us at Erez Crossing. And we were taken the very first day that we were there. We were taken to the area where the Nasrallah home still stood. And it was the only home left in that entire area. What I remember saying and feeling at the time was that house was sitting in a sea of rubble because the Israeli military was destroying homes wholesale. Later, Human Rights Watch said that happened in the absence of military necessity. And over 16,000 people, I think, from 2000 to 2004, lost their homes at the time. That day, we sat on the floor in the Nasrallah family's home and ate a wonderful lunch meal with Om Karim, with Abu Karim, and with their very young children at the time. We were taken to the spot by Abu Karim, showing us exactly where Rachel had been when she was killed. It was a very emotional day. We hugged. We saw the rooms in the house where Rachel had spent time with the children and the family. They pulled off their Arabic English dictionary from the shelf and had me read, try to pronounce the words in Arabic. And they told me how Rachel was so much better at it than I was. And we saw also the space at the foot of the Nasrallah parents' bed, which was at the backside of the house, where Rachel would sleep, she said, in a puddle of blankets with the children, because military people and machines would drive through that border area at night and they would shoot into the houses. And there were bullet holes marking the entire home.
We just have 30 seconds, and I just wanted to get your final comment, either Cindy or Craig, on what is happening today.
Amy, that family did everything they could to hold on to that house. They were eventually forced out of that house, and some of them went through 7 other houses. Now we hear that they want out of Gaza. After 21 years of trying to hold on to their homes and their lives and their futures and their past in Gaza, like so many people, they want to survive and they want out. I can't imagine what drives them to do that, but that's the situation in Gaza.
I want to thank you both for being with us again, Craig and Cindy Corey, speaking to us from Olympia, Washington. And Tom Dale will link to your piece in Jacobin, Rachel Corey Gave Her Life for Palestine, joining us from London. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Check out our website at democracynow.org.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
From the This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.